From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a conversation with Anita Hill. It's been 6 years since her testimony transformed the Clarence Thomas hearings into the Hill-Thomas hearings, sparking a national debate about sexual harassment and about who told the truth. She's written a memoir called Speaking Truth to Power. Also, Roy Lichtenstein, one of the founders of pop art, died yesterday at the age of 73. We remember him with a 1993 interview. And TV critic David Bianculli previews tonight's season opener of NYPD Blue. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel does not intend to change its policy on Jewish settlements when peace talks resume with the Palestinians next week. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright announced the resumption of Israeli-Palestinian peace talks after a six-month hiatus. The talks will begin next Monday and will also be attended by U.S. Peace Envoy Dennis Ross. She said one of the issues to be discussed is her call for a timeout on Jewish settlement expansion. Israel's foreign minister said Israel is willing to consider a timeout during the final status talks, which Israel would like to start soon. But Israeli officials rushed to backpedal today. Netanyahu said Israel's building of houses and settlements is for what he called natural growth, and he said that won't change. Jerusalem Mayor Ehud Olmert also said today that Israel will not stop building a controversial new settlement in East Jerusalem. The Israeli statements today are likely to anger Palestinians, who say the settlement issue is at the top of their agenda. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Attackers armed with guns and knives have reportedly killed more than 80 people in a series of separate attacks in Algeria. Dozens were from a single family, and the bodies of most of the victims were mutilated and burned. It was the latest violence in the country's long-running Islamic insurgency. The Clinton administration is taking new steps to fight housing discrimination. The measures include $15 million to help the states enforce housing regulations and a doubling of the number of discrimination cases the Department of Housing and Urban Development will pursue. Defense attorneys are trying to distance Terry Nichols from Timothy McVeigh as they resume jury selection procedures in the second Oklahoma City bombing trial in Denver. Prosecutors, though, say that Nichols was a key player in the bombing. The Major League Baseball playoffs begin today with six of the eight qualifying teams in action. In just about an hour, the Atlanta Braves and the Houston Astros will kick off the first of the postseason games, as NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
Atlanta has been baseball's team of the 90s. This year, the Braves were as good as ever. They were the only team to win 100 games, and they won their division a record six straight time. But while the Braves have appeared in four of the past five World Series, they've won only once, beating Cleveland in 1995. Anything short of a championship this season, and cynics may give Atlanta a new label, baseball's underachievers of the 90s. Following Atlanta's game today against Houston, the Florida Marlins host San Francisco, and the defending champion New York Yankees play Cleveland. Tomorrow, the Baltimore Orioles play Seattle. These playoffs may be policed more closely than in the past. Major League umpires are angry that baseball still hasn't adopted an on-field code of conduct. It's reported that today, umpires are expected to announce a no-tolerance policy toward what they consider disrespectful behavior. Tom Goldman, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 29 points. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, stocks have turned mixed following the release of the latest economic statistics from the government. The market had been lower all morning as weakness in the high-tech sector spread to the rest of the stock market. More from Bloomberg's Doug Krisner.
Investors are awaiting the outcome of today's meeting on interest rate policy at the Federal Reserve. The consensus view expects the Fed to make no change, given evidence of moderate economic growth combined with low inflation. Indeed, the day's economic news supports the notion of stable rates. New home sales unexpectedly fell in August, while manufacturing in the Midwest was weaker than expected in September. At the same time, consumer confidence held steady. The market is sagging under the weight of weaker high technology issues. This follows warnings from Western Digital and Ascend Communications that earnings will fail to meet expectations. I'm Doug Krisner.
A federal administrative judge has just ruled that Toys R Us unfairly used its corporate muscle as the nation's largest toy seller to block toy manufacturers from supplying merchandise to low-priced shopping clubs. The company allegedly managed to convince toy makers to sell only so-called value packs of several toys or discontinued items to the clubs. The judge's ruling prohibits Toys R Us from pressuring suppliers or making agreements with them to hold back toys from shopping clubs in the future. The order becomes effective within 60 days unless it's appealed to the full Federal Trade Commission. A Japanese hotel is letting its customers decide how much to pay for rooms and meals. The Hotel Nagoya Castle says it still expects to make a profit because the novelty should draw new guests. Patrons get to see the hotel's suggested price and then write their own amount in. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In 1991, Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas polarized the nation. She testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee that the Supreme Court nominee had sexually harassed her when she worked for him at the Department of Education and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Several books have investigated what went on behind the scenes, who lied, who told the truth, and why. Now Anita Hill offers her version of the story in her new book, Speaking Truth to Power. The hearings turned Anita Hill into a reluctant public figure. She seems to have given up on returning to her pre-hearings life. She has left her teaching position at the University of Oklahoma and is now lecturing across the country on sexual harassment and civil rights in the workplace. She's currently at work on a book about sexual harassment. When Anita Hill worked for Thomas at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, she was asked to review the commission's position on sexual harassment. She says that when she read the position, she was flooded with embarrassment. I asked her why.
Well, I suppose what it was like was seeing a description of what had happened to me in front of me and the realization that even though I knew that the law was there, I still felt powerless to interact with the law, to engage the law, and do anything about it.
I'd really like to hear a little bit more about what was going through your mind when you felt that you were sexually harassed by your boss, who happened to be the head of the EEOC, which created policy on sexual harassment. So tell me some of the things that went through your mind about how you might handle that.
Well, it created all kinds of conflicts with me internally, of course, because you feel, when you look at a law like that, you feel responsible to the people that the law is there to address. What it reminds you of is that the law is really only as effective as society is willing to allow it to be. And until society opens up to the need for the law and the willingness to support and enforce the law is not going to be effective.
Why did you proceed with the attitude that you couldn't engage the law, that you couldn't file sexual harassment charges?
Well, I think for me, there were just a whole variety of conflicting feelings about it. I think there were the typical feelings of self-blame and doubt. But in addition, it was a realization that Clarence Thomas was the head of the enforcement agency and that there really isn't a provision in the law that says to me, this is where you go if you're going to file a claim against the person who is the chief enforcement officer. So there was no direct process for me to pursue a claim.
What about the self-blame and doubt that you mentioned? What were you doubtful of? What were you blaming yourself for? What were you unsure of?
Well, I think the first line of blame was, why did I ever work with him to start with? I had a very good job. And
a job in the corporate world.
I had a job in a private law firm, and it wasn't as satisfying as I would have liked it for it to have been, but it was a good job. I left because I really wanted to work in civil rights. And I really kind of went out on a limb moving from something that was very stable to a job that was really tied into the politics of the city. So the first doubt I had was, wow, I should have never left my job to start with. The other line of blame, I think, is it just comes from upbringing and socialization, where you think, wow, what this is about is something that I did maybe to suggest that I was available in this way. I think we're socialized to believe, as women, we're socialized to believe that we have control over the sexual approaches of men. And there was part of that that was going on in my mind, that I believed that somehow I could control it. And not having controlled it, I was at fault.
Anita Hill is my guest, and she's written a memoir called Speaking Truth to Power. When Clarence Thomas made lewd jokes to you and talked about his favorite pornography and pressured you to go out with him, would you go home at night and kind of strategize and say, the next time he says something like that, I'm going to do this, I'm going to say that?
No, I'd just go home and I'd try to forget about it.
Did you think that was the best survival strategy for yourself?
Well, I don't think I thought about it as the best. I think it was an instinctive survival strategy. I don't think I sat around and tried to have any strategy. It was, I did it rather naturally, to go home and try to put it out of my mind and go on with my life. And I think that strategy continued even after I left the agency.
What was your first reaction when you heard about Clarence Thomas's nomination to the Supreme Court?
My first reaction was, it was surprise, because all the press reports had really suggested that someone else would be nominated. There was a short list, and he may have been mentioned, but he was not considered to be the person who would be nominated. So I was very, very surprised. And then, I guess for my surprise, I went to really confusion about what, if anything, would be my role in the process. I did understand that there were very thorough checks for people who were nominated. And I assumed that I would be contacted. And what I would be asked was really out. It was hanging over me. The kinds of questions, the kinds of probes. And I assumed it would be thorough, and I assumed that I would be involved.
So your attitude was that you weren't going to come forward, but you would answer any questions you were asked?
My attitude was that I wouldn't have to come forward, that they would come to me.
Were you surprised at how long it took for them to come to you?
I was very surprised, particularly when I learned in the nomination, the day of the nomination, from a New York Times reporter. So I knew that my name was out there as an individual who had worked with Clarence Thomas in two different positions. So I was very surprised at how long it took for them to reach me, for the Senate to reach me.
Did you ever consider just coming forward and not waiting for them?
I thought about it. But at the same time, I wasn't really certain of how the political process that the nomination had become would use the information. And I realized, as well as I think the rest of the country realized, how highly political this whole process had become. He was the second African-American to be nominated to the court. He had some very strong supporters among people who one might not think would be his supporters. And he had some very vocal detractors. And so there was a very heated debate about the nomination. I was afraid, really, that the information that I had would become part of the political debate as opposed to the substantive debate on his fitness for the position.
When you finally were approached by the Judiciary Committee, you said you wanted to keep anything you had to say confidential and you didn't want Clarence Thomas to know what you'd said.
I didn't say that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
I did not say that. That has been part of the information that is out there. I indicated to the Senate staffer who was investigating that I wanted a thorough investigation. I didn't want them to just take my statement and then go to Clarence Thomas and give him a chance to deny it before they had done any kind of investigating. I did sit down at one point after I had sent my statement to the Senate Judiciary Committee. I did sit down and talk to FBI agents. They then went and spoke with my one corroborating witness who I had spoken with and whose name I had given to the committee. We had one interview, and I was told that follow-up interviews were customary, routine, in fact. There was no follow-up interview. I did not get the sense at all that the agent sent had any experience in the issue of sexual harassment or any experience in terms of how to question an individual about the behavior that I was talking about. And I think that their investigation really wasn't thorough. Their questioning was not thorough. In hindsight, I think that the first thing that should have been done was to have brought somebody in who had some experience with the problem that was being discussed. And I mean, that's a first step, but I think there should have been more follow-up and it should have been more thorough.
My guest is Anita Hill. She's written a memoir called Speaking Truth to Power. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Anita Hill is my guest, and she's written a new memoir called Speaking Truth to Power. Your book concludes with an open letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee of 1991, and you write, "Your failure to avail yourselves of available sexual harassment experts is inexcusable. It can only be explained as arrogance or willful ignorance." What are some of the most serious ways that you think the Senate Judiciary Committee's investigation violated the spirit of sexual harassment guidelines?
Well, throughout the hearing, and even before the hearing started, there was misinformation, misstatements, or statements that showed misunderstanding of the law. For example, you have Arlen Specter saying, well, since there was no touching, no physical threat, no physical violation, then there is no violation of the law. And that's clearly wrong. You had other individuals during the hearing really manipulating the rules in a way that did not allow a discussion of the issue. You had misstatements about who the targets of sexual harassment are. For example, Senator Hatch suggested that the sexual harassment only occurs to women who are young and women who are in positions such as secretarial positions. So there was all kinds of misinformation that they were not only using to evaluate the claim, but they were also spreading to the public. And that's what made it egregious. I mean, that's what made their failure to resort to real information egregious. That they misinformed themselves, they misinformed the process, and they misinformed the public as well.
It must have been pretty difficult for you when you were testifying to the Senate Judiciary Committee in front of national television cameras to have to talk about Long Dong Silver and to quote, you know, him as having said, "Who put that pubic hair on my Coke?" Did you in advance try to plan the tone that you would have? Did you mentally rehearse it so that it would have the gravity that you wanted it to without sounding silly or without inducing giggles? I mean, this is real giggle territory for a lot of people, and you needed to present it in a way so that it wasn't giggle stuff.
Well, I think the setting really set the tone for it. I didn't have time to practice. I arrived in Washington on Wednesday night. I had a statement to prepare and just had to get together with my advisors, Sue Ross and Charles Ogletree, and Emma Jordan, to really talk about what I might expect in terms of questioning. That was on Thursday. And then Friday morning, I testified. So there was no time to rehearse, even if I had thought to rehearse how I would say what I was going to say. And I also have to say that it happened also very quickly, that things were even more things were coming back to me as the questions continued through the day of the testimony. So, yes, it was, I'm sure a lot of people must have snickered and giggled. But I tell you, in that hearing room, once the testimony started, there was very little of that. So I think the tone was really set by the setting. And to the credit of the press in that hearing room, I think they realized how difficult it was for me to be sitting there doing what I did on that day. And I think they made an effort to keep it serious.
What did you fix your eyes on as you were giving the testimony? Did you look at the person who was asking you the questions? Did you stare off into space?
As much as I recall, I tried to look at the person asking the questions. And one of the reasons that I was really trying to look at the person asking the questions, some of the questions weren't really all that articulate. And I was looking at their facial expressions to try to figure out what it was they were saying, what they were getting at, what they were trying to get from me. So that was really part of communications, just looking at them and looking them in their eyes and trying to figure out how we could communicate to each other better.
Were you ever worried when you were testifying that either you'd become so emotionally involved in the testimony and in the memories and in the way you felt you were being treated that you would tear up and start to cry, or that you'd become so angry at all of it that you'd lose your temper and lose control, the control that you actually maintained through the whole proceeding?
Well, before the hearing, I gave myself a task to accomplish. And that task was to tell the Senate Judiciary Committee what had happened to me, to tell them about the behavior. Now, my task, I made this bargain with myself, my task was not to convince them, but it was to tell them as clearly as I possibly could. I didn't get angry. I didn't get dismayed as long as I could stick to that task. I didn't really feel disappointed even that they weren't convinced, that they were still cynical and somehow just didn't believe what I was saying, because I realized that it wasn't my job to make them believe, but it was my job to tell them the truth. And so as long as I could do that, I felt fairly comfortable. Now, I did get frustrated a few times because I felt that what I was saying wasn't clear. And that was when I got frustrated, when I didn't think that I was being as clear as I possibly could be.
What were the questions from Judiciary Committee members that you found most offensive?
You know, the questions themselves, it's hard to say which I found most offensive. I think that the tone of Senator Spector's questioning, in that each one seemed to be designed to suggest that what I was saying was absolutely incredible, that it was beyond the experience of any woman, much less myself. I found that whole idea offensive, and I think that colored every question that was asked me, particularly by the Republican senators. There was one point at which Senator Spector was questioning me, and I had I said in my statement and in a question from Senator Biden, I had said that one of the very offensive things that took place was that the descriptions of pornography of women with large breasts and men with large penises engaged in different kinds of sex, that had been the most offensive. Senator Spector then asked a question that was a suggestion that I was being prudish because I found the word breasts offensive. Now, he left out all of the other information that I had given the committee and focused on the words breast and suggested that I was just being silly to think that that was so awful that someone should say breast in the workplace. I found that was the attitude that prevailed throughout the questioning, and I found that very offensive.
Anita Hill has written a memoir called Speaking Truth to Power. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Anita Hill. Also, we remember Roy Lichtenstein, the great pop artist who died yesterday at the age of 73. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the season opener of NYPD Blue. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Anita Hill. She's written a new memoir called Speaking Truth to Power. Much of the book is about the Clarence Thomas hearings. She testified that the Supreme Court nominee sexually harassed her when she worked for him at the Department of Education and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. You were at the center of like a nationwide Rorschach test, because everybody was taking sides. Did they believe you or Clarence Thomas? And whatever side you chose said something about how you saw yourself in terms of a race and gender and politics. I'd like to just talk about that a little bit and about being in the center of all of that. Now, Clarence Thomas said that he was a victim of high-tech lynching. But you were an African-American woman who was testifying against him. How did it make you feel, the assumption being maybe that you were lynching him because he was a black man?
I think one of the tragedies of the hearing was that the discussion really sort of centered around his race and my gender, as though he had no gender and I had no race that came into that should have come into the discussion. So I think that's one of the problems with the hearing. They did not see me as a full person. So they were able to use me as sort of this surrogate to a person who came in and accused him of sexual wrongdoing and therefore added to what he called this high-tech lynching. His use of the metaphor was clearly inappropriate since I am an African-American woman. Nevertheless, it did take, and what happened, or the result of it, was that in many ways, I was shunned by the African-American community. I shouldn't say the African-American community, because that's too much of a generalization. I was shunned by certain people who claimed to speak on behalf of the African-American community. And the shunning occurred because I had brought about shame to Clarence Thomas that would be heaped upon the entire community.
Did you feel like you were in any way betraying the black community by telling what had happened?
Absolutely not. My feeling was that Clarence Thomas did what he did not so much because of his race, but because of his gender and the power that that goes socially from that, or flows socially from that. But more importantly, I grew up and came of age during the civil rights movement, and my lesson from the civil rights movement is that you tell the truth about your experience, even if it's painful. You have to tell the truth. And by telling the truth, we liberate ourselves and we liberate the entire community. And that was what I drew from the civil rights movement. And I felt that I was following those instructions in coming forward to testify. I did not think that I was betraying that at all.
How did the rejection that you experienced from some African Americans affect you?
It was devastating, because this was the community of the cultural community of my upbringing, and it was the community with which I had identified culturally, in which I identified physically, and that I think in many ways defines who I am as an individual. So it was really hard to have that experience, to feel as though you were ostracized by a community that you had embraced prior. Now, I worked in civil rights because I wanted to help the African-American community in particular, but really all oppressed minorities. And so to be ostracized was really quite painful.
Do you feel like the story would have played out really differently if Clarence Thomas were a white man who had said the same things to you that you say Clarence Thomas said, or if you were a white woman who was accusing Clarence Thomas of saying the things that you accused him of?
I think in both cases it would have played out differently. And I'll take the latter case. Had I been a white woman, I think that many members of the committee would have been more reluctant to fully embrace Clarence Thomas and to view me as someone who had no political significance or any other kind of significance to them in their experience. I think Clarence Thomas was a member of their club. He may have been an honorary member, but he was clearly a member of their club, and they were able to embrace him and completely reject me because I was in no form or fashion a member of their club. I even believe that had I been a white woman, that Clarence Thomas may have been less likely to claim a lynching, that it was my race and my gender that made me insignificant to them, and that allowed them to question my sanity, allowed them to question whether I was a fit professional, that allowed them to question sexuality, that allowed them to raise all kinds of questions about me that were completely inappropriate for the setting.
If you could replay the first interactions that you had with Clarence Thomas in which he spoke to you in inappropriate ways, would you have gone public with that if you had it to do all over again?
You know, I try not to look at this situation mm-hmm. in that respect because what I did was made a choice that was not about outcome. I didn't say, I'm going to come forward because the result will be X, Y, Z. It was not result-driven. It was, I believe, the appropriate and right thing to do to and for the process that was before me. We're talking about a Supreme Court nomination. We're talking about Senate staffers who've come to me that have this information, and I need to give them as much as I have. It was a decision of principle. It wasn't a decision based on the thought that I was going to create some result. So outcome really shouldn't now look at me and say, I shouldn't look at outcome and say, well, I would do it or I wouldn't do it again, because that wasn't the goal to start with.
Do the feelings of rejection that you had after the Clarence Thomas hearings, have those feelings eased? Do you feel like you have been more accepted again?
I think some people have accepted me. I think that we're working through some issues, particularly in the African-American community, that we had not been working through at a very quick pace before. There will be always people who won't accept me. There will always be people who believe that I lied under oath. And I have learned to accept that. That doesn't stop me from living and doing what I need to do and what I think is important to do.
Just one more quick question. Are you more wary of friends or colleagues having seen the kind of divisions, potent divisions that could happen?
Some of my friendships have intensified, and some of my friendships have sort of fallen away. But I cannot let the experience keep me from establishing and maintaining relationships. Those relationships in many ways, whether with family or friends and even sometimes with strangers, were what maintained me and kept me alive throughout this ordeal. I realize how important they are. And so I continue to try to have those and to have open and honest relationships with a whole number of people. So I'm not paranoid or completely suspicious of people. I still want to interact with people, and I want to do so as a professional and also as a personal friend.
Anita Hill, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Anita Hill's new memoir is called Speaking Truth to Power. Coming up, we remember artist Roy Lichtenstein. He died yesterday. This is Fresh Air. Roy Lichtenstein was one of the first and one of the greatest pop artists. He died yesterday at the age of 73. The cause was complications from pneumonia. Lichtenstein helped to bring the style and subject matter of pop culture into the fine arts. He put wham and blam into his paintings, literally. His early paintings were inspired by comic books. In fact, they looked just like frames from romance comics, war comics, and Mickey Mouse comics, including the thought balloons and the Sacco Pow exclamations. In later years, he continued to use the visual language of comics, bright colors outlined in black, often filled in with color dots, although the subject matter had shifted to interiors and advertising images. I spoke with Roy Lichtenstein in 1993, at the time of a major retrospective at the Guggenheim Museum. I asked him why he wanted to do his own versions of romance comics and war comics.
I guess what I liked about both of them is that they're both emotional in different ways. I mean, the war things are full of action, and the women are crying,
right. You
know, or waiting for telephone calls or something. And that is the stereotype portrayed in comic books at the time, which really reflected the feeling of society. And but the idea of doing highly emotional subject matter in a very dry, mechanical, removed way seemed to symbolize something about where society was. I mean, wars were being waged at a push of the button and things like that.
In one of your love comics, a worried woman is asking the man who is with her, it's not an engagement ring, is it? And in the catalog that accompanies your show at the Guggenheim, they reprint the comic that you base that on. It's from a Winnie Winkle comic.
Mm-hmm.
And the context that comes from, the woman is saying, Perry, about this piece of jewelry you're planning to buy for Tanya. And he says, I just want to show her how much she means to me. And then the woman says, it's not an engagement ring, is it?
I know. It's a completely different thing when it's taken out of context.
Yeah. So now, what interested you in that particular Winnie Winkle?
Well, it wasn't the Winnie Winkle. It was just a pretty girl and a handsome man,
mm-hmm.
and those stereotypes. And the cliché of being enthralled about engagement rings. I mean, I'm sure everyone is even now, but it seemed like a male and a female thing to do.
Now, did you ever hear from the original artists who did the strips that you...
Well, I've really only heard from William Overgaard, and he wrote me a nice letter saying he was so pleased to see his work in the Guggenheim Museum. he did Steve Roper, and he said several things which are quite cogent about pop artists and cartoonists and things like that. But he's really, I think, the only one I've heard from. Nobody's ever said, you know, you stole my cartoon or something like that.
Another love comic that ends up, or love comic type image that ends up really being about the art world is a woman is saying to the man, why Bart, darling, this painting is a masterpiece. My, soon you'll have all of New York clamoring for your work. did that come from something, or did you just make that one up?
No, it came from almost all the lines come from I can't make up lines like that. I think that was a line connected to that particular cartoon. I may have edited it a little bit. Sometimes they take lines from other cartoons or two together,
uh-huh.
or edit it in some way. You know, I want it to sound either more general or more confused or whatever strikes me, you know, about what I liked about the line.
You did a series of paintings of brushstrokes. And, of course, in abstract expressionism, you know, brushstrokes and dripping paint were about what it was all about. I mean, it was about seeing the action, the process of the painting, the hand of the painter, the drip of the paint.
Yeah.
But of course, the brushstrokes that you painted had no real dripping paint at all. I mean, the drips were carefully colored in. was this your comment on abstract expressionism, this kind of ironic version of brushstrokes?
No, I think it was a comment on the comparison between that bravura act that they did with paint and the my way of representing it, which is it's where I'm painstakingly drawing the brushstroke up, you know, as though I were painting something difficult to paint, you know, and that one is romantic and the other is classical, and that it's really a drawing of an ideal brushstroke or something that looks like a brushstroke. And it doesn't fool you. I mean, you don't think it's real, that's really a brushstroke, but you think it's a picture of a brushstroke, and, you know, that's a kind of absurd thing to do. And so it has that built-in absurdity, and that's the reason I like it.
There's a chapter in the catalog that accompanies your Guggenheim show, a chapter that's called Clichés into Icons. Mm-hmm. Is that what you see yourself as doing, transforming clichés into icons?
Well, I like the idea, and I do think that there's a relationship between classical art and cliché. I mean, the Greeks or Romans, we look at as trying to make ideal figures or ideals of beauty and that sort of thing. And so are comic strip people. They're making an ideal pretty girl or handsome man or whatever the thing is, rocket ship. And but one is thought of as important and the other isn't. And but by making archetypes, I am trying to make them into icons. And if you, particularly even in sculpture where I isolate something, you know, it can be a lamp that's standing on its light rays, you know, or something like that, or a German expressionist head or something. I try to make it as cliched or as typical or whatever it is. And that's really the same thing, I think, as making it classical.
You know what I'm asking about? The style that you paint in, that style that looks like mechanical reproduction but isn't, this is a style that you appropriated from mass culture. But it seems to me at this point it's become something else. It's become your style. It's become your personal style. So painting in that style must feel really different than it did when you started. It must have really become a way to express yourself, to a very personal vocabulary for you. One that you must be very comfortable with.
Yeah, I think
with.
That's, you're explaining it very well, that because it originally had that meaning, this is printing and so forth, and I don't think that's, even though it still may mean that, it certainly not doesn't reveal anything, and it's just become a way of making colors. So now, or tonalities, I use dots and diagonals and dots that graduate from thick to thin, and I mix them up in the painting with other colors, and it just became a way of working, and if I could find a way out, I would be happy to do that, you know, but the way has to mean something, and I tried one group, which I like a lot, of landscapes are made of brushstrokes, some of which are real brushstrokes and some are cartooned brushstrokes, and they work together in the painting, and it gives the painting a certain interesting surface, which I would have disdained a few years ago. But so I'm trying to do various things and trying to extend it, but I don't want to make it complicated or decorative. And I like the plainness of it, but it is just the way I work. And it's interesting that what would become every man's style, I mean, you know, is very recognizable.
All of your paintings, or maybe I should say most of your paintings, come from print matter, from a two-dimensional source, from a, mm-hmm. from comics or from advertisements or in some cases from other paintings. You seldom, if ever, paint from life itself.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? I mean, you know, there's the tradition in art that mm-hmm. you're painting from the still life or the model or the landscape. You're painting from life, not from a reproduction of life.
Yeah. Well, I know that. I even did that before. I mean, when I was in the 50s, I had several shows in New York, which not many people know about, and the work was kind of expressionist and cubist and, you know, very derivative in retrospect. And it was from historical paintings or paintings of cowboys and Indians or something like that. So I always seem to have used two-dimensional sources. And, you know, I mean, I feel that artists are always using two-dimensional sources. They just think they're using three-dimensional sources. In other words, if we all started to learn to draw and paint simply by looking at the model, we'd all be painting like children. You know, it really is that you're painting in terms of the history of art. And you're really making a drawing of a life model the way Michelangelo did. You know, I don't mean that there have been no advances in this, but mostly all of that seeing is learned from looking at two-dimensional sources, not three-dimensional sources. That's not really the reason I do it, but...
The real reason is...
The real reason is I have no idea.
Right, okay.
Like the real reason for everything.
I'll buy that.
Yeah.
Roy Lichtenstein, recorded in 1993. He died yesterday at the age of 73. Coming up, a preview of the season opener of NYPD Blue. This is Fresh Air. In May, when the ABC cop series NYPD Blue presented its season finale, viewers were left with a powerful cliffhanger. Bobby Simone, played by Jimmy Smits, was suspended from the force, his reputation smeared, while his partner, Andy Sipowicz, played by Dennis Franz, was implicated in the murder of a man who had helped frame Simone. The new season of NYPD Blue starts tonight, and TV critic David Bianculli has this preview.
As the new season of NYPD Blue begins, Andy Sipowicz and Bobby Simone haven't seen each other all summer. Bobby, still off the force, is working at a bar and agonizing over the possibility that his best friend Andy may have tried to protect him by killing someone in cold blood. Meanwhile, Andy is stewing at home and at work, wondering why Bobby hasn't called and doesn't seem to care. Finally, in the street language of NYPD Blue, Bobby reaches out to Andy, and the two have a very intense meeting at the precinct house about the ongoing grand jury investigation.
I gotta ask, Andy, could they have more?
More what?
Could they have statements you pulled the trigger? They're holding back to see where I go.
They could have statements. I'm Ann Margaret. If you're asking, did I shoot the guy? I already told you no.
Yeah.
I was worried for you. I followed you to take your back. Somebody shoots Salvo. I drive up to see, are you all right? If you want, I'll be the witness. You say take off.
But I was thinking maybe you did it.
I told you I didn't. I just told you so again.
You mind not breaking all pistols?
I followed you to back you.
I know that you were backing me.
I'm sorry. It got things complicated.
Yeah, well, that's the way it worked out.
Do what you gotta do. Put me there. Let them try to prove I pulled the
Andy,
trigger.
This is not about me trying to get from under this. If I was looking to do that, I would have done it 4 months ago.
Well, it's been 4 months for viewers, too. One-third of a year between first-run episodes of NYPD Blue. It's been too long a wait, but tonight's season opener almost makes it worth it. Not that there's a lot of real suspense here. Loyal viewers of this show know that while Andy may do some questionable things, and one time even asked Bobby to track down and murder the killers of his son Andy Jr., Andy Sipowicz simply wouldn't do the crime. He wouldn't have killed that guy at the end of last season's show, and NYPD Blue fans are sure of it. Just like fans of The X-Files know that Mulder didn't kill himself in that show's season finale, but that's another story. The good news is, the makers of NYPD Blue know that viewers know that Andy is innocent, so they waste no time clearing up that particular plotline. Instead, tonight's NYPD Blue spends most of its time checking out relationships, exploring the lighter sides of quite a few regular characters, and presenting a pair of rather graphic romantic scenes. One scene involves relatively new cast member Andrea Thompson as Jill Kirkendall, who was shown tonight in a very revealing clinch with a surprise suitor. The other scene, a shared bath between Jimmy Smits's Bobby Simone and Kim Delaney's Diane Russell, has a lot of skin and action above water level, and some very suggestive things going on just below the surface. And for those who keep track of or care about such things, there's a brief shot of Jimmy Smits without any briefs. The camera shot is from the rear, and of the rear. Yeah, NYPD Blue is back, and I'm glad it is. No ifs, ands, or buts.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu and Monique Nazareth. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.